not as much importance or emphasis on addressing the issue.
A new plan for addressing air quality in Fairbanks upsets the mayor of North Pole. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Lynn Connell plane crash survivor talks about her recovery.
And that whole time I was just praying the whole time, Lord, I'm not ready to die, not yet, please.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is requesting that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency no longer consider Fairbanks and North Pole together when it comes to air quality regulation. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, if approved, the change could free Fairbanks from more stringent emissions regulations.
Fairbanks and North Pole are currently regulated as a single entity by the Environmental Protection Agency, an EPA-designated fine particulate pollution non-attainment area for wintertime emissions, primarily wood and coal smoke, covers Fairbanks to the west and North Pole to the east, but the community's air quality are no longer on par.
On the western side, the air quality appears to be improving.
Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Program Manager Cindy Heil says Fairbanks and North Pole have diverged relative to a federal 35 microgram per cubic meter pollution standard.
The three-year rolling average for the western half is below the standard of 35, where the North Pole design value is now at 139.
Several factors play into the growing disparity, including the concentration of wood and coal burners and localized atmospheric conditions that trap smoke in neighborhoods. Heil says DEC's requested division of the non-attainment area would keep Fairbanks from being covered under an impending EPA serious air quality designation.
The Clean Air Act is very prescriptive about this. In June of 2016, the current air quality non-attainment area will become serious, and because of that, there's going to be more increasing requirements for us to do what's called best available control technologies. And then if we fail to meet attainment by 2019, we will have to put in most stringent measures.
North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward opposes dividing the area, fearing it'll make it more difficult for his small city to reduce pollution.
Not as much importance or emphasis on addressing the issue.
Ward says that could include inability to leverage grants and other resources to combat air pollution. The EPA could take over a year to rule on the DEC request. Meanwhile, Ward is looking toward the state-supported Interior Energy Project to help ease the air quality situation.
We did have the gas lines that were put in this last year. I'm definitely excited about getting gas in those lines because I think that's going to solve a lot of these problems.
The state is currently reviewing five finalist company proposals for getting clean-burning natural gas to the Fairbanks North Pole area. Selection of a project partner is expected in December. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The North Pole Police Department is launching a program aimed at combating a persistent theft problem in the city. At a public event this week, North Pole Police Chief Steve Dutra introduced the Anti-Theft Dot system that helps with recovery of stolen items.
We have a lot of things getting taken and the property seems to be building up and we can't return that property. So with this system here, it allows us to be able to return the property to the rightful owner.
Anti-theft dots are sand grain-sized identification chips embedded in decals and paint that can be applied to personal property like electronics, tools, and bicycles. Owners log an associated PIN number online. If an item is stolen, Dutra says police can scan it for an ID.
We can look at those dots and the serial numbers and cross-check them against the database. And there we'd be able to identify the true owner.
Dutra says that will cut down on thieves' ability to sell stolen items and enable police to return otherwise unidentifiable property, which he says is an issue.
And we have to turn around and sell it at auction.
North Pole Police handed out anti-theft dot kits at the rollout event. The identification dots are also available at some local retailers. The North Pole Police Department is the first in Alaska to initiate the program, but Chief Dutra says there's interest outside the area. The University of Alaska Anchorage's women's basketball team took second place in the Great Alaska Shootout, falling to Western Kentucky 62-58. After blowing out Pepperdine in the first round, UAA coach Ryan McCarthy was unhappy with the team showing in the championship game.
We just didn't follow our game plan, even remotely close. I was very disappointed in our effort. I thought was very B+.
UAA finished the first half with a one-point lead, but after taking over the lead in the third quarter, Western Kentucky didn't give it back. McCarthy says rebounding was a big difference maker.
One of our goals was we needed to scrap out rebounds and box out. We did not do that remotely close in the second half. Just got out-hustled, and really, to Western's credit, they wanted it more than we did, as much as it pains me to say that.
Western Kentucky out-rebounded the Seawolves 24-14 in the second half. The Seawolves were just a three-point shot away from forcing overtime when, with 2 seconds left in the game, Western Kentucky sophomore Ivy Brown cemented the Lady Toppers' victory with a free throw. Despite the disappointing loss, Coach McCarthy says there are several things the team can take away from the tournament.
We can look back on this and we can pick out the areas that we didn't give our best effort, that we didn't execute a game plan, and hopefully learn from those mistakes as we head into league coming up this next week.
UAA opens up its conference schedule on Thursday of next week against Simon Fraser University. George Mason beat Pepperdine 71-63, taking third place in the women's tournament. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a cemetery caretaker's longtime commitment to respect for the dead.
That's the fourth generation nest of the raven I made friends with 30 years ago.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Martha Makowiak has returned to Haines after spending 2 weeks in a Seattle hospital. She, her husband Mike, son Nick, and family friend Victoria Hansen were on board a private plane that crashed into Lynn Canal on November 4th. Martha suffered severe hypothermia and cardiac arrest after swimming to shore. She had to be resuscitated twice. KHNS's Jillian Rogers sat down with Martha at her home.
Sitting at her kitchen table on a recent chilly morning, Martha looks healthy and happy. She's moving a little slowly, and she says she's tired most of the time, but otherwise, she says, she feels good. During our conversation, Martha used the word miracle several times. She says on that day a few weeks ago, as soon as she knew the plane was in serious trouble, she started praying and didn't stop.
Michael said I made it kind of, I was within about 10 feet of the shore when I dipped under. But I was swimming mostly on my back, and I kept turning around to see how much further I had to go. And there was a bigger swell than I expected, and that kept washing over me. And that whole time I was just praying the whole time, Lord, I'm not ready to die, not yet, please.
The flight started normally that day, she says, a little cloudy in Juneau, but nothing out of the ordinary. Martha and Nick were on their way home from a college visit in Idaho and were set to take the ferry back to Haines, but Mike offered to pick them up in their plane. Partway through the flight, the plane stalled.
It was just like, oh my goodness, this is it. We're gonna go down. And he was hoping for a beach landing. And when he turned around, he could see an area that had potential. But just the conditions with the wind and everything, he was pretty quick to recognize that we weren't going to make that beach. And so he set it down as best as he could. I know we flipped. I just remember, you know, the water coming in, and we all got out. It felt like within seconds he had had us open the doors right before we landed, because apparently sometimes the frame can interfere with that if there's an impact.
She says, remarkably, everyone on board remained calm. Her husband gave them instructions as the plane headed for the water.
And he had had us, you know, he said, have your hand on your seatbelt so that as soon as we're down, you can get unbuckled. And we just pulled right out. So we all got out. So we all got out onto the wing. Michael was the last one out. His foot was stuck, but he was able to just pull his foot out of his shoe. So we just launched off the wing to swim for shore. And I probably, apparently naively thought, okay, there's the shore. We can make it.
They all swam toward shore. Martha was just shy of the rocky beach when a wave overtook her. She says her son Nick jumped in and pulled her out. Mike then resuscitated her when they made it to shore. After an hour or so, a Temsco helicopter was the first to arrive. But the nightmare continued. Once at Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital, she had a cardiac episode and had to be revived again. She also had to be intubated and was given warm fluids intravenously to get her core temperature up. Doctors then put her under to operate.
Apparently there was a lot of pressure building in my abdomen from the salt water and the gases and everything in there, and it was putting so much pressure on my lungs and heart that that didn't look good for me. So that's when they decided to open me up and relieve that pressure.
Then Martha was medevaced to Seattle. She says she vaguely remembers being on the plane, which made it there quickly because of a strong tailwind.
The pilot said he'd never seen tailwinds like that. We got there in an hour and 40 minutes. So that's just another one of those little details.
It took her a couple days of recovery in Seattle before she understood what was happening. She says the outpouring of support and prayers continues to astound her. From friends and family far and wide to the nurses and doctors who took care of her in Juneau and Seattle, and the Temsco pilot that rescued her off the beach. While she may have lingering effects from the hypothermia, Martha is expected to make a nearly full recovery. In Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Canadian regulators say a mine about 40 miles northeast of Juneau has agreed to reduce pollution leaking into a nearby river, but it won't have to restart a shuttered water treatment plant many southeast Alaskans want back in operation. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the latest on the controversy surrounding the Tulsiqua Chief Mine.
Current owner Chieftain Metals Corporation did install pollution control equipment several years ago, but it shut it down because of its high cost. Critics in Alaska want the provincial government to force the company to start it up again. But at least for now, that's not going to happen.
There are things that the company can do short of firing up a full water treatment plant at that site that will make a difference.
Bill Bennett is British Columbia's Minister of Mining and Energy. His agency and two others recently notified the Tulsiqua Chief Mine that it's out of compliance with its provincial permits.
We have asked them for a plan showing us how they would make some changes there that would, you know, alleviate some of the issues, such as the spilled oil and in some cases some water going directly into the river. There are ways that they can divert that water. They can put it through settling ponds. There's a number of things they can do.
This is just kind of putting a Band-Aid on the issue or kind of dancing around the margins.
Chris Zimmer is with Rivers Without Borders, which has campaigned for transboundary mine safety for about 15 years. He says diverting more mine water into settling ponds won't do the job. That's because they're small and will eventually overflow.
So essentially what Bennett is saying is we're going to do a few minor things around here, but the biggest problem of this direct discharge of polluted water to the river, we're not going to be able to do anything about.
Bennett says his government is not giving up on the water treatment plant. It's told mine owners to prepare a plan for reactivation within 90 days. But he says forcing that to happen now could push Chieftain toward bankruptcy.
We want this company to be able to build a mine there so that they can operate this water treatment plant and pay for the improvements that are necessary.
The news comes as state and provincial leaders work on agreements giving Alaska a larger role in transboundary mine regulation. Tulsiqua Chief's owners could not be reached immediately for comment. The Chieftain Metals website did not appear to include any response to the notices of violation or criticism from Alaskans. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
State Museum officials in Juneau say they have an opportunity to do something they've never done before. KTOO's Matt Miller reports that they're starting with a blank slate when creating exhibits that chronicle the various periods and native peoples of Alaska.
And it's a pretty tall order to wrap your head around the task that we've been put to, which is to build a whole new exhibit from scratch, basically.
That's Steve Henriksen, curator of collections at the old Alaska State Museum in Juneau that has since been demolished. Henriksen says some of their old exhibit displays used to be cobbled together on a shoestring and with salvaged materials over the years. That's not the case for the Father Andrew P. Kashevaroff State Library Archives and Museum building that's now under construction in the same place in downtown Juneau. He says they'll show native artifacts from all regions of Alaska, but their displays will likely have a Tlingit emphasis since the museum is located in the heart of Tlingit territory.
The theories of how migration happened or if it happened and in what direction are changing so much that we'll try to reflect some of that uncertainty in the exhibits. We're trying to get away from having definitive answers about history that's contested.
Henriksen says original house posts and a house screen that were on loan and displayed in the old museum's Tlingit clan house have been returned to Klukwan in Seattle. A new Tlingit clan house is now being built inside the new museum.
When houses like this have been put into museum exhibits before, there's been a tendency to try to skirt the thorny issue of whose house to put up by creating something that really never existed before, Eagle Raven House, or having a house that had everybody's crests in there as part of the carvings on the house posts.
Henriksen says visitors are usually confused. Instead, he says, they're working with Occoquan members to accurately depict the house as belonging to a representative clan of one moiety as the host. Hats from the other moiety will be on display inside the house. The clan house will include objects ranging from several hundred-year-old artifacts to contemporary native art, like a painted panel by Jim Schopert.
It's going to be continually reinforced that Alaska natives, Tlingits, and other tribes are still here and still doing many of their traditional activities. So there won't be this implicit understanding that all of those people were just in the past and have been assimilated.
Elsewhere in the museum, Henriksen says cross-cultural exhibits will show similarities and compare differences between all Alaska Native groups and tribes on trade, art, basketry, bentwood objects, and watercraft. The grand opening of the Father Andrew P. Kashevaroff State Library, Archives, and Museum is planned for May. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Tim Bodoni. This week on AK, vandals. On a clear night in September, a group of vandals desecrated a 200-year-old cemetery in Sitka, tipping over headstones. The caretaker, 65-year-old Bob Sam, discovered the damage the next morning. Some of the marble slabs were broken beyond repair. This is the story of how the cemetery caretaker enlisted the help of local police to protect the rights of the dead. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Bob Sam tends to keep to himself. He always wears jeans patched with dirt on the knee from hours spent packing earth. He's a slight man with the voice of someone who has spent a lot of time with the dead.
Most humans, they think about life. They don't think about death so much. But somebody has to do this work.
Sam's life's work has been restoring Sitka's Russian Orthodox cemetery, which he visited often as a child. One day, when he was 7 years old, he discovered his grandmother sitting solemnly by the family plot.
My grandmother had kind of a tear coming out of her eye. There was beer cans all over the place and brush was overgrown. I just quietly looked at my grandmother and I says, "Don't worry, Grandma. I'll fix this place for you."
It was a promise he kept. Sam returned to Sitka at age 30. He discovered graves desecrated, headstones buried by mounds of trash, and the clearing claimed by the rainforest. So he got to work on the longest day of the year, June 21st, 1986. That summer's cleanup required 30 city dump trucks to haul away the garbage. Community members helped with the heavy lifting. And now?
There's something special about this place now. People can feel it.
The cemetery clearing is pristine. Sloping hills dotted with pillars of white marble and birdsong. The first time I visited him there, Sam guided my eyes to the top of an enormous cedar tree.
That's the fourth generation nest of the raven I made friends with 30 years ago.
This summer, he personally washed all the headstones, removing dead pollen and revealing the natural patina of the marble. There are 400 of them, and the vast majority mark Tlingit and Aleut graves.
When you're washing a headstone, it's no different than washing somebody's feet. And you experience a kind of humility. No matter what they do in life, they should have a respectful death.
Sam had just finished washing the headstones when on the morning of September 12th, he discovered the cemetery had been desecrated. The biggest headstones were knocked flat to the ground.
My spirit broke.
Sam hadn't touched alcohol for decades, but that day he ordered a beer.
The beer was sitting in front of me, but then I thought about it. I can't live that life. I got up and I called the police.
The officer he got on the phone was Lieutenant Lance Ewers. Ewers told Sam to meet him at the cemetery and spent the next hour taking pictures of the damage. In Alaska, desecrating a cemetery is a Class C felony. Here's Ewers.
We started doing some extra patrols in the area, and then I saw Mr. Sam the other day, and together we came up with an idea of like what it would take to fix these tombstones, because some of them are 700 pounds. They're super heavy. And he said, you know, it would just take muscle, a lot of muscle.
And muscle is exactly what Ewers found. He banded together a dozen recruits from Sitka's Trooper Academy, and they set the headstones upright. There was a heavy downpour that night. Sam watched them work in the mud.
I always thought that I was the only one that cared about this place, which was wrong.
The vandals would strike three more times. And each time, recruits from the academy, Sitka police, and even some firefighters volunteered to lift the headstones out of the dirt and stand them upright.
And they would assure me every single time, "Bob, if you need any help in anything, just give us a call." Like a friend would.
The culprits were eventually caught. Sam told me he considered giving up this work entirely, but he changed his mind when seeing how the community took the cemetery under its wing.
These are Native American graves, and to have people from all walks of life come in to do the things that they are doing, and their whole heart and soul is into it, really touches me.
So Sam continues his work, because he believes that one day a generation who wonders who they are will wander into the cemetery and find an answer written in stone. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Ronald Spatz, who moved to Anchorage in 1980.
Well, I like to think now that I am at least sourdough starter. There is a sense of freedom about Alaska. It's so beautiful and so alive. And I think, I am one now. I can't imagine myself at least living full-time anywhere else. One of the places that I absolutely loved was going to Cordova to see the fishing community, and then before the road was washed out, going all the way out to see these two glaciers sort of colliding with each other, facing each other out there on the Million Dollar Road, see what happened after the 64 earthquake. You get to experiencing things and people that you would never imagine possible. So, for example, even in terms of the foundation of the state, we still get to meet people like Vic Fisher, who wrote the Constitution. You get to meet people who stood up for the rights of folks. I mean, there's an intimacy about Alaska. There's an openness, and there's a history that you can see and that you are making and that is being made around you. I guess that's the thing that's the most amazing when I think about it right now. It is, in fact, not only is the landscape around you alive and dynamic, all the seasons of the year, you hear it, you have earthquakes, you have volcanoes, you have northern lights, you know, you have all the weather, you have all the changes, but you also have history that you can see the beginnings of in lots of ways and how that's evolving. I mean, it's an amazing place. It is an amazing state.
Ronald Spatz is a professor at UAA in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Emily Kwong, Lori Townsend, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Tim Bodoni.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jillian Rogers in Haines, Josh Edge in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld and Matt Miller in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.